Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and more West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 302 of Registry Matters. Larry, good evening. How are you? Welcome back.
Doing awesome. Glad that you were willing to have me back for one more episode.
Just one more. This is it. This is it. And then Chance, how are you this evening?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Travis is looking at the Google Doc and making me wonder if he's trying to highlight something. But during I just want to tell you that during pre-show, we were listening to some AI renditions of Larry singing The Thunder Rolls, which was quite hilarious. Chance, what did you think?
I think he ought to, you know, contract. He's got to be on the contract.
Remember to show your support by hitting like and subscribe and 5-star reviews and, you know, those things that are necessary for us to grow the podcast and grow the Registry Matters Army. We truly appreciate your love and support. And in return, we will keep delivering the content that you guys need to change the universe. So, Larry, what are we doing this episode?
Well, we're going to be doing some great stuff that you put most of the content together on castration, both chemical and physical. Also, I want to go over a recent submission that we received about recantations. And we actually received an angry letter wanting to know why I can't understand the issue any better. And I checked our vast FYP archives and discovered we last discussed this actually on two episodes recently. Not recently, but two episodes in the not too distant past, episode 204 and 207, and both of those are more than 2 years ago. And we have a California corner with Chance and a couple of articles if time permits.
Well, very good. Well, let's go right into this angry gram from a reader. It says, Dear FYP, I've got a significant issue with you two, especially Larry. For some reason, cannot seem to understand that my accuser recanted over 20 years ago. In fact, I sent proof, which I'm sure you are afraid to show the world, which we will do. Nonetheless, I've been a subscriber to your transcript service for over 2 years, and Larry himself once admitted that recanted testimony had worked. Why aren't you interested in my case? And I recall that episode, Larry. I remember that it was a case where it had worked, and I was shocked as well. What do you want to tell this person?
Well, I've communicated the following to him. A recantation in and of itself is generally insufficient to overturn a conviction. Now, keep in mind, a person who recants is de facto a liar. They've told more than one version of an event. And from the point that they recant and tell a conflicting and different story, they are a proven liar, and nothing they can say or do will be considered reliable. So at the point that they've done that, you're going to need additional evidence. Forensics is best, but you're going to need something that corroborates the recantation. And without that, it's very difficult that you're going to gain any traction because people tend to regret what's happened after they see the consequences. They weren't expecting the person to get 20, 30, 40, 50 years in prison. And they have buyer's remorse, whatever, and it's just there'd be a revolving door of recantation. So let's just get Chance in here. Do you see it differently?
No. I see it just about the same. You know, while recantations do happen, you know, they're not automatically considered a strong basis for reopening a case. Courts carefully evaluate the circumstances surrounding a recantation before deciding whether it warrants further consideration.
Do me a favor, remind the audience why it worked in the case where we discussed in episodes 204 and 207.
Sure. I went and retrieved the transcript, and I'll just read mostly what I said with a couple of changes to make it read better. It worked because it was procedural in a different place. She recanted before there was conviction, before there was any on-the-record testimony, before he, the accused, had actually admitted and stipulated to the facts of any sexual offense by this guilty plea. See, that's what everybody misses. When you recant after there's been a trial, and the person's been sworn in under oath. She recanted early in the process before there had been a conviction, before he had even admitted to doing the sexual offenses. And I just lost my screen here. He made some admissions, and we went through those during the podcast, but he did not admit to doing the naughty things he was accused of sexually. And he admitted to breaking her phone, as I recall, and I think he admitted to tying her, which is false imprisonment or a similar charge to that. But he did not admit anything that she was alleging sexually. But she was very clever, and she probably even had some coaching from maybe the defense attorney. She raised her mental stability as an issue in her own affidavit of recantation. She says, "I have a propensity to say things that are not true." Well, if I'm a defense attorney, I'm going to have a field day with that. I'd say, "Oh, really? So you're mentally unstable. Is that what you're saying? Why should we rely on you?" So in all likelihood, she had some help in writing that affidavit. But what could the prosecutor do? The prosecutor, she had to disclose to the court, and she did the ethical thing. She stated, "I don't have a case. At least I don't have a complete case." And she didn't have a complete case, particularly related to the sexual offenses. And that's what happened. Those charges went away.
But so then why are prosecutors so dead set against recanted testimony?
Well, we're going to certainly get chance in on this, but for a number of reasons. First, they don't want to have the conviction reversed. That would mean having to put the case together again. Second, the prosecution realizes when their star witness that lacks credibility if they should attempt to try the case again. So you've got a star witness that your former conviction rested upon who's now a no longer credible witness. And the prosecutor's got sense enough to know what's going to happen. So if I'm a defense attorney, I'm going to make certain that the jury knows that the person has recanted. And at the very least, the jury will likely need additional evidence to convict, which they could do because there could be strong evidence. But I would make sure that they knew that this person had recanted. I would figure out a way to get it in.
Well, you know, as for the courts, you know, aside from why prosecutors are dead set against recanted testimony, as for the courts, a recantation isn't a ground for granting a new trial because it makes a mockery of the court and would place the investigation of truth at the mercy of unscrupulous witnesses. You know, moreover, retractions are easy to extort out of witnesses. In contrast, their previous statements are made under oath, in the presence of a judge, and with the opportunity to cross-examine. Therefore, the original testimony should be given more credence or weight. However, the exception to this rule is when, aside from the testimony of the retracting witness, there's no other evidence to support the conviction of the accused. In this case, the retraction by the sole witness creates doubt, or a doubt, in the mind of the judge as to the guilt of the accused. A new trial may be granted under those circumstances, but if there is other evidence contrary and independent of the retracted testimony, unlikely, there can be no new trial.
So, well, it's very confusing to people because they don't understand the motivations that could cause recantation. I just illuminated a couple. You know, you could have buyer's remorse, but there are more sinister motivations. There could be monetary incentives. There could be a bribe offered. There could be threats made. There could be so many things that could cause a person to recant. And since we don't know any of those things that could be underlying the motivation, it could be that your conscience is getting to you, but we don't know any of those things. It's much better, since the due process occurred by either the admission of the accused or the weighting of the evidence by the trier of fact, be it judge or jury, it's better to let that stand rather than letting a person have buyer's remorse or be threatened or something happen later and let a person that could have been guilty of those offenses run free. So that's, in a nutshell, you're not going to get anywhere most of the times with just a recanted statement.
I'm inclined to think that a significant number of these kinds of crimes, I guess if it's a contact kind of crime, not a picture-oriented one, that there almost isn't any physical evidence. It's all he said, she said. And so now the person that he said, she said is now saying he said, she said didn't. Now you have the one person that said they did saying that they didn't. How would you figure out which side of that story to take?
Well, you do raise a good point, because in the buyer's remorse sexual cases where the person may have had buyer's remorse, you would not likely have much in the way of forensics. But you don't just have forensics to go on. You also have other evidence that might come in related to digital communications that have taken place between the person. And you could have a body of evidence that might still be very compelling, maybe not absolute proof, but you might could get to a guilty verdict with limited evidence without physical evidence. And that's why a lot of the statutory schemes around the country say that independent evidence is not required. That's in the sexual statutes of many states. It'll say that just the person's accusation is enough. But Chance, you can illuminate that. You've done more trials on this than I have. But what else does it take when you've got a person where it was he said it was consensual. She came in 2 weeks later, or a month later, and said it wasn't. How do you do that?
Well, you know, again, and this is what I was just saying a moment ago. You know, if the retraction's by a sole witness, right, that kind of creates a doubt in the mind of a judge. So here we go. We're looking at things that are surrounding, you know, the testimony as it was made originally versus the retraction. I mean, what's out there? Well, a whole bunch of stuff is out there that can be totally congruent with or contrary to what this retraction is. In other words, there can be other evidence to the contrary that was admitted as part of the original testimony, which, you know, absent the testimony, supports exactly what the testimony was in the first place. And there could be nothing whereby an explanation such as what we were talking about just a moment ago in your example in revisiting a prior episode, if it's this kind of sole case where the retractor is giving justifications for why they might have said what they said previously, that really bodes in favor of the retraction. So just a bunch of things. But if you're thinking about what it is that can really come around and make or break it, it's what's happening now right in front of us everywhere we look on CNN and everywhere else. There's documents, there's emails, there's phone calls. There's so many ways of communicating today that could either buffer, you know, up the previous testimony or totally destroy it.
Anything else here?
Nope. I think we've done the best we can. And I do try to understand his point, but he's got a long sentence that's going to likely result in dying in prison. He's looking for hope, and I don't really have any hope to offer based on what he's submitted. That's not going to get him where he's trying to go.
I did just put the affidavit up on the screen if you want to go over it real quick before we cut out of here.
Well, if you want to read it, you're a better reader just with the redacted names. But yeah, sure. What was said?
Well, so it says, I, so-and-so, hereby clarify that the accusations and charges made against so-and-so are false. I would like to end this matter by dropping all charges I have placed against him. There are currently 4 charges I have placed and would like to dissolve them at this time. In conclusion of this matter, I would like to be notified when this letter is received. If any questions or problems should arise, please feel free to contact me at any time. And it's all signed and witnessed and all that other good stuff by the whatever notary person. And this doesn't then make it all certified and all that?
Well, that document is all certified, but it doesn't undo the conviction, because the conviction stands until something else surfaces, because this person's word is worth nothing now because they've told you 2 different stories.
But then the person was convicted on the statement of the person whose testimony means nothing.
Well, it meant something at the time. It was under oath, as Chance said, and it was consistent with the other body of evidence that was admitted. And this person changing their mind and saying they lied is not going to carry the day unless something else can be brought in. And that's what I keep trying to communicate. You've got to find something else.
Very well. We will move along. Just getting our special guest prepared here. All right. Well, then we have this thing that got everyone's hackles all up, and there was a ton of chatter everywhere. And this is Louisiana man to have his junk removed. And this comes from WREG in Memphis, and I also found another article from USA Today. A Louisiana man convicted of doing unspeakable things to a teenage girl will have his male parts removed as part of his sentencing, which includes a 50-year stint in prison and physical castration. The victim's pregnancy resulted from the assault, and DNA test confirmed the perpetrator was the father. Larry, would you be so kind to give us some more details about this case that has everyone talking?
Yes, according to reports, Glenn Sullivan Sr., a 54-year-old man from Louisiana, was convicted of multiple counts of sexual assault against a teenage girl. The allegations against him are disturbing, and the severity of the crimes is what makes the case so notable.
And then from there, can you walk us through the specifics of the case? What were the allegations against Sullivan?
From what I've gathered, I haven't followed this as closely as others, Sullivan was accused of repeatedly assaulting the teenage girl over a period of several years. The victim was allegedly impregnated as a result of these assaults. Now, that is really something for years and years that this took place, if these allegations were true.
Well, assuming since he was convicted of it, I'll take it on faith that he was found guilty of it all. But that, you're right, that is disturbing. So, Chance, would you just shed some light on the legal background here? What are the implications of the case in terms of Louisiana law?
Absolutely. Andy, as Larry mentioned, Sullivan was convicted under Article 1443 of the Louisiana Revised Statutes, which pertains to chemical or physical castration as a punishment for certain sex crimes. In summary, in Louisiana, those convicted of certain sex crimes may undergo chemical or physical castration as part of their sentence if they give their voluntary consent. The defendant's decision is made by the court after considering factors such as age, health status, past criminal history. It's important to note that while the defendant's choice may have been informed by their understanding of the potential consequences, they ultimately choose to undergo this procedure voluntarily in order to avoid further legal consequences.
And can you then explain what that means exactly? How does this specific law apply to Sullivan's case?
Well, sure. Now, under this law, Sullivan had the option to undergo either chemical or physical castration as part of his sentence. Chemical castration involves administering medication to reduce an individual's libido and/or sex drive.
And then what about the physical castration part? How does that work?
Well, it's a surgical procedure that removes the testicles, essentially rendering an individual capable of reproducing. It's a more invasive and irreversible measure than, say, chemical castration. I just get nervous talking about it. It hurts.
I know, right? We don't really want to talk about having your Ghibli bits removed. All right, Larry, let's talk about the sentencing aspect of this case. And under the revised statute, I assume that's what RS means, revised statute 14:43, the defendant has the option to choose chemical or physical castration as part of their punishment.
That's right. And I'm going to pontificate a little bit about that, because the way Chance answered earlier, it's almost like it sounds like there's a choice about whether they undergo either of the procedures. It sounds like to me that we need clarification. They must choose one of the other. Castration is what they have to choose. It's just a form of castration. But anyway, the law gives the defendant the opportunity to opt for either chemical or physical. And the chemical involves administering medication to reduce the individual's libido and sexual drive, or physical, which is the surgical. And I understand you actually have an expert on hand for tonight.
I do. And we've had Travis on before. I tried desperately to figure out where we had him on, but I could not find it. Anyway, Travis, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Could you remind us what your credentials are, so to speak?
I have a bachelor's in biotechnology and biochemistry, and I have a doctor in pharmacology from one of the top schools in the country. So.
And this isn't like a paper mill, right?
Right. This is one of the major universities in the South. UNC Chapel Hill. I also have about 10 years of experience working with patients, as well as research. So I've been around a little bit.
Gotcha. Well, I do appreciate it. I only asked you, like, I don't know what it was, 2 hours ago, if you could come on. And I don't want to waste your time. So what, in your pharmaceutical professional opinion, the drug that does the chemical castration, what does it do? How long does it work? Are there side effects? And ultimately, why would someone pick going under the knife to remove their manly bits versus taking a pill?
Well, so castration, I mean, it's obviously a very sensitive subject, regardless of if this is chemical versus if it's surgical. And it's important to note that both methods have, you know, very serious ethical, psychological, and physical implications. So chemical castration involves the administration of a medication to suppress the production of testosterone. But as I mentioned before when I was on the show, this was not without its drawbacks. There are significant undergo hot flashes, weight gain, depression, and even osteoporosis, kidney issues, the number of things. You know, it's not something that I would want to subject someone to without regard to their past medical history. Furthermore, the treatment, unlike physical castration, is not permanent, which is to say it can be inconvenient and costly, but, you know, at least, you know, it's a reversible thing. Surgical castration, on the other hand, is a more permanent option, but it's not without its own set of concerns. Obviously, there's concerns with complications from anesthesia. There are people that, you know, probably could not get cleared for surgery, really. There are probably going to be significant hemodynamic changes with surgery, which, you know, that has to do with the, you know, the blood flow in the body and, you know, the stability of that. Also, we have to worry about things like surgical complications from infections, and the psychological impact of this procedure can be very profound. It can lead to depression and a lot of mental health issues. But moreover, these options do not address the root cause of problematic sexual behavior. This requires more comprehensive psychological treatment. It's also worth considering ethical implications of an invasive procedure, as a form of punishment as opposed to a treatment. As far as this being FDA approved, there are some FDA approvals in terms of things that would require castration as a form of treatment. In particular, I'm looking at prostate and testicular cancer. In fact, surgical castration was actually a pretty common procedure in back in the old days, back before we had chemical castration, as a means to treat prostate and testicular cancer. These cancers actually respond and grow in response to testosterone. But, you know, there were some major drawbacks, and that was the main reason that we switched to chemical castration in these procedures.
You can't speak to cost-wise. I mean, is this a generic 50-cent pill, or is this one of those, like, $200, to keep taking it for such an extended period of time, like, forever, would it eventually be more expensive than the surgery side?
It could be over time, because you also have to consider things like the monitoring parameters that you would have to take into account. It can be cost prohibitive potentially, and that is possibly something that needs to be taken into consideration. I really think that the fact that this is even on the table as a punishment option really kind of is taking us back to the days of the barbarians, but
it's in the law, man. I was reading through the law. It covers it. You can choose either or, and there's punishment if you say, I would like to do the chemical version, and you don't show up. And, like, you as a pharmacist, you're going to have to observe him take his pill and make sure it's not underneath his tongue, hidden somewhere in his mouth, whatever, like they do in prison, and you got to do the whole, like, tongue depressor thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, do you or Chance, do you guys have any questions for Travis?
No. No, I'm really too much in pain right now to even think about asking the question.
You don't want to hear more about the Ghibli bits being cut off?
Heck no.
All right, well, look, Travis, can you walk us through how this process might work? How does the defendant, I wrote in here that, does the person have a pamphlet? Do you want your Ghibli bits removed or shrunk? I don't know. What happens?
In terms of when they're presented with the option, I'm not sure what sort of educational things that they're offering. But as my understanding, though, they have to make an informed decision about which option they prefer. They need to consider factors like medical history, potential side effects, medication or surgery, and how this is going to impact their quality of life. But, you know, to what extent they're providing or, you know, really giving strong, giving the education needed to really make some of these decisions, I'm not sure.
Let's skip over to the removal of the man bits. What are some of the key points that someone would have to consider before they have their junk taken off?
Well, one of the main things to think before the procedure is, you know, there's no chance of reproduction later. This is a definitive solution. It's done. And it's a much more invasive option. And, you know, there are significant risks of dying, infection, bleeds. I've even run into some situations where, you know, it can, you know, the major surgical infections can, you know, have lifelong consequences. As far as why someone might choose surgical castration over chemical castration, the reasons could vary. They may opt for the surgery as it's a permanent solution and they're unable to tolerate the long-term side effects of the medication. However, these aren't without side effects as well. Additionally, surgical castration is a once and done, whereas chemical castration is an ongoing treatment, and it's a complex decision that should be made in consultation with a healthcare professional, taking into account all the aspects of an individual's overall health, lifestyle, and personal preferences.
Travis, I really, really appreciate you shedding the professional side of other me making up terrible jokes about Ghibli bits. But so in respect for your time, though, I appreciate you jumping on the podcast at the last minute. I'll let you go so we can keep talking about the boring legal stuff.
Thank you. I really appreciate your letting me join.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
All right. Thanks, you too.
So back to, like I said, the boring legal stuff. Chance, how does this process work in terms of insuring? I mean, can you think of other kinds of scenarios where a person has to make some kind of choice like this? Either or, both are bad?
Well, that's a great question. Let's go back a minute. The court would need to ensure that the defendant has had sufficient time and information to make their decision. So they'd also need to consider any mitigating circumstances like age or health concerns. But, you know, as far as any other examples, nah, I mean, that's kind of where, and I don't want to say where the rubber meets the road, because that doesn't sound right in this situation, but, you know.
And I can't imagine how they would make sure he has enough information to do this. Like, perhaps there's a pamphlet that he could choose, the pill or the knife. I'm trying to figure out how this one actually plays out, and I don't see how it comes out well.
Well, you know, I don't see how anybody could ever have enough information, but, you know, in this case, to ensure that Solvent has sufficient information about the castration procedure and its potential side effects, it is likely that he would receive a thorough explanation from medical professionals prior to making his decision. There would also be resources available to him, such as counseling or support groups, to help him process what has happened and make informed decisions about his health and well-being. As Travis said before, you know, maybe.
And I guess that's really crucial for this case. How do you think the courts would balance the need for punishment with the importance of ensuring an informed decision?
Well, you know, if this really isn't punishment geared toward Mr. Solomon, well, Andy, that's a tough one. The court would need to carefully weigh the severity of the offense against the individual's right to make their own choices. It's a delicate balancing act.
Now, Chance, as our resident legal scholar, expert, extraordinaire, Esquire, I've heard this expression that says, blah, 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 life, liberty, and property, and some other hullabaloo. Where does this intersect with all that?
Well, it doesn't include man bits in there, but let's talk about the concept of life, liberty, and perhaps personal property as a fundamental right that has roots in Enlightenment philosophy, particularly in the works of John Locke. Now, Locke argued that these were natural rights granted to individuals and that the primary role of government should be to protect these rights. The philosophy significantly influenced the development of political systems in the West, notably shaping the foundational documents and principles of the United States. For instance, in the U.S. Constitution, these rights are safeguarded by the Fifth and the 14th Amendments, which ensure that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property, or in this case, giblets, without due process of law.
They're probably this part of this property.
Oh, yeah, a very valued piece of personal property, or pieces in this case. This principle, known as due process, mandates that the government must follow fair procedures and cannot arbitrarily take away these rights. The Fifth Amendment applies the standard to the federal government, while the 14th Amendment extends it to the states, also adding the requirement of equal protection under the law. These amendments make the philosophical principles of Locke actionable, ensuring that any deprivation of life, liberty, or property must be preceded by a legal process that justly and equitably applies the law, thus binding the government to a standard of fairness and accountability in its intersections, or I'm sorry, got caught up with this whole surgery thing, in its interactions yes. with individuals.
That would have been incisions if you wanted to make the slip the right way, the Freudian slip.
Yeah.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
What do you think about the whole situation? I mean, if he's locked up, this is like my little armchair lawyering. He's 54 years old now, and he's been given 50 years in prison. Based on it being Louisiana, he's probably not ever eligible for any sort of early release. That'll make him the spry young age of 104 when he's released. Does this seem reasonable? What do you think, Larry?
Honestly, I've got so much disgust with this. I can't even begin to know where to start. It's way over the top. And, you know, having been born in June of 1841, and we've got a listener who doesn't believe I was born in 1841, and I told him I served in the Lincoln administration, and he doesn't believe that, but that's when I was born, 1841. I understand the gravity of the crimes, and physical and chemical castration are both extreme measures. And as you've heard me pontificate for years on this program, politicians listen very carefully. You could do this constitutionally if you would do it correctly, just like I tried to tell you other things you could do if you would do it correctly by narrowly tailoring. You could do this from a constitutional perspective if you would give them a true choice, meaning that the judge is standing there, sitting there on the bench, and the judge says, well, you know, your attorney should have gone over the options you have at sentencing. Under the law, I'm required to give you a mandatory minimum of 50 years. But there's a mitigation component in the law that would allow the court to deviate downward from that 50-year imposition if you were to choose a form of castration. And under the law, if you were to choose one of the forms of castration, I could deviate down by 2/3 or whatever the case may be. Then you've given a person a true choice. Then you can get onto the informed consent about that choice and what the pros and cons are. But there's no choice here. You're getting the 50 years plus the castration. The only choice is between the two forms of castration. There's no choice about whether you have it. I hope that the people in Louisiana have this shoved up their you-know-what with a constitutional challenge. I'm disgusted with people in Louisiana that they would enact such a thing. That will never pass in my state in my lifetime. I will guarantee you that. I doubt it'll ever pass in California in Chance's lifetime. But in the Bible Belt, where people are so forgiving and where they show up in masses at church on Sunday, that you could pass something like this is utterly disgusting to me, beyond disgusting. And we've talked a little bit in pre-show about technology. This is an example of where technology hurts us. Back in 1841, back in 1932, back in 1965, back in 1985, and on and on until about the year maybe 1995, 2000, there was very little visibility in the legislative process. You were not able to put the mob in the decision-making process, and cooler heads were often able to prevail because all this stuff wasn't visible on the internet in continuous feeds. Now all this debate takes place with continuous live stream, continuous 24-hour commentary about how the legislators are being soft on criminals, and it puts a conservative legislator in a conservative state like Louisiana in a conundrum. Even if they have morality problems with this, they're under an enormous amount of pressure to pass it because they're not shielded like they used to be pre-technology, with the technology we have today. Like I say, you don't even have to go back that far. Probably about 25 years is all you need to go back. And most of this stuff would have been done in a public forum, but only the public that lived near the Capitol would be there. Now the whole world is watching in real time. So this is one of the downsides of the technology that we all love so much today.
Chance, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I'm listening to Larry, I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, it is extreme. You know, my view is that castration violates an offender's implied right to privacy under the 14th Amendment, rights of due process and equal protection, and the 8th Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, exactly for the reason Larry stated. In this case, it seems like the purpose is not so much to punish or keep Mr. Sullivan from acting out again, but is to generally deter the public from engaging in this kind of behavior. And while physical castration might not be the most effective way to prevent recidivism, it does send a strong, if not horrific, message that these crimes will not be tolerated. But the issue is it right? Is it constitutional? And I believe it is not, and it is not.
One of the main reasons why I wanted to even bring this up, especially with both of you here, is that Larry, often we go back to the founding fathers, and they did not find that killing someone for execution is unconstitutional without due process, or with due process, you can execute somebody. This is less than execution, and he had due process. So doesn't that make this constitutional?
Some states believe it is and have implemented it.
Clearly.
But is it really? I mean, measured against these things I've said, Larry brings up this great point. What are we calling due process here? Being forced to make a choice between two things that are just horrific.
Equally bad.
Horrific, think about things in terms of equal protection. I mean, think about the whole idea of a woman having, the right over her own body versus the government telling her what she needs to do. I mean, on the flip side, and think about things like, cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, the guy's going to be incarcerated like forever. What's the point? Double, right. Triple. Well, how many times do you have to double down on punishment? Again, I don't think it's aimed at this individual as much as scaring the hell out of everybody else so that they don't engage in this kind of behavior.
I mean, the law, I don't remember the exact year, but it was in the late 2000s, like 2008 or 9 or something like that is when this was signed into.
Yeah, wow.
So it's been around for a little while. It's not like they made this law for this dude.
Hmm.
Well, all right then. Chance, take it away with some California-ness.
All right. All right, gentlemen. And I use that term loosely. Let's go into California Corner. Today, I want to talk just a little bit about failure to register because I get a lot of calls about it and people are concerned about it. And as we get down to the end of this, I'll explain how that applies here in this case. But let's just talk about failure to register since everybody's familiar with it across the country. Let's talk about it in California. In California, Penal Code Section 290 PC is a California law requiring that individuals convicted of certain crimes, primarily sex offenses, to register as sex offenders in their local with their local authorities. Registration must be renewed every year and whenever an offender changes his or her residence. That's the general rule. Failure to do so is typically charged as a misdemeanor if the underlying sex crime was a misdemeanor, or a felony if the underlying sex crime was a felony. A misdemeanor conviction carries up to 1 year in jail. A felony carries up to 3 years in prison. Now let's talk a little bit about the elements of proof. Let's take it this way. The prosecutor must prove four things in order to convict a defendant under the statute in the state of California. They have to show that the accused was previously convicted of a California sex crime for which registration was required under PC 290. Now, I'm saying this in a general sense because it could be an out-of-state person who now resides in California. So it doesn't necessarily mean a California sex crime, but I'm saying in general for the state of California. So one, you've got to be previously convicted of a sex crime requiring registration under 290 PC. Two, an accused has to reside in California. For purposes of 290, PC 290, Penal Code 290, residence means one or more addresses at which a person regularly resides. So, you know, it could be their primary address and, say, a secondary address that they've established. They stay at their primary address, but, you know, elsewhere they're there maybe once or twice a month, maybe more than that. Three, they've got to know. An accused knew he had a duty to register as a sex offender. So they have to have actual knowledge of the duty to register as a sex offender, and that's required. This requirement places that burden upon the authorities, meaning the courts, probation, or parole. You must be informed of the duty to register in order to have actual knowledge of it. And forgetfulness is not a defense. And then the last element, which is willfully. An accused willfully failed to register or update his or her registration with the sheriff's office. Willfully in this context means when done willingly or on purpose. You with me so far, guys?
Totally with you.
Okay. So how can it sounds almost like it's the type of crime that, you know, you can't, it just sounds like, you know, when it's done, it's done. Let's talk about defenses. It's not done when it's done. Okay, there is some wiggle room here. So here it is. Alleged violations can be challenged by raising a legal defense. And really good lawyering in this area can get a charge reduced or dismissed, can cause an acquittal. Okay, so let's go into it. No willful act. An accused is only guilty under this code section if he willfully failed to register as a sex offender. This means that it's always a legal defense for an accused to show that he did not act willingly or on purpose. For example, perhaps an offender did not register because he or she was hospitalized and couldn't get there, or suffering from an illness that affects his or her mental capacities. I mean, it could even be sleep apnea, for Christ's sake. There's a whole lot of things that can prevent you from, you know, exercising good mental judgment or having the capability to recall dates and things like that. So that is a defensible position. Another one is the authorities make an error. Under this defense, an accused would argue that he or she was not informed or misinformed upon submitting all of his or her registration information to the police. And the strength of this defense rests on whether or not the accused can offer evidence that substantiates their claim. For example, it comes up on occasion where a failure to register is alleged in omissions on a registration form. Something was left out of it. Something wasn't put in that the form was asking for. An accused may be able to use the videotape of the flawed registration process to substantiate their claim. What do I mean by that? All officers doing these things nowadays have body cams, and they use them in the registration process mostly to help convict people who are, of course, charged with failures to register because they didn't do something right. Well, it can be flipped. What if they misinformed somebody? What if they misinformed a registrant on a particular question they asked during the process? If there's a videotape of it, it can go a long way in making this thing go away. Now let's move on to another defense, no knowledge, because I think this is a big one, and this is really the strongest one. A prosecutor must prove that a defendant knew of his or her duty to register as a sex offender. Now, this is a strong defense for an accused to show, okay, especially that they had no knowledge of the duty to register. For example, perhaps a peace officer during the registration process failed to clearly articulate the duty or the accused did not understand his or her registration requirements. This could happen in establishing a secondary residence in California for the purpose of terminating sex registration, in that the form requires that you list all places you register at. Now, you're in California and you get this form, and on the form it says, you know, put down all places you register at. You may have thought that it only means within the state of California. And so you don't put the out-of-state address, when in fact it means anywhere in or outside the state of California. If you make that mistake and it's an omission, it could cause you a great deal of stress when you're charged with failure to register, especially if the underlying offense is a felony, because you're looking at potential prison time. So, you know, the bottom line is, and the thing to know is, know exactly what it takes in order to establish this offense and defend against it in terms of doing things that could cause you to suffer from one of these allegations.
Gentlemen? I have a question, and I would really, and I'm going to need Larry to focus it, because I'm going to speak in layperson gibberish, that there was a presentation I heard about strict liability, that these things like this shouldn't, like, they are treated strict liability, and if you just make a mistake, like, you shouldn't just be guilty and thrown in jail forever. But if you aren't aware of a speed limit, then, you know, you're just, here's your $50 or $200 ticket. You're not thrown in prison for, oh, I made a mistake. But this stuff, the consequences for, whoops, are incredibly severe.
Yes, they are severe. And I, you know, I love the idea that you bring up this concept of strict liability, because that's, most people think that, you know, when it's done, which is layman's term for strict liability. And that's the idea of understanding what the elements of proof require and understanding what's a defensible position, because many, many, many people fall into these defensible positions and they don't know. And, you know, they don't take the time to find out by consulting with an attorney or someone who might know. They seem to think that they're strictly liable and they just plead to these things over and over and over again. And it just causes all kinds of havoc. It can cause incarceration, either locally or in prison. It can also set you back in terms of termination of the requirement to register in California, because those are taken into consideration when you're petitioning. A misdemeanor can set you back a year. A felony conviction can set you back 3 years in tolling the statute. So it just takes more time to get your relief.
Well, did I articulate that question well enough, Larry?
You did, and strict liability doesn't kick in here. Registration is not a strict liability offense in any jurisdiction where I've examined the registration scheme. You have to have notice of the duty to register. You have to have knowledge of the duty to register. That's one of the things why I get so upset with people who've been discharged from registration, the paranoia that they hold about that they might get in trouble in another state. They might actually get in trouble in another state. But the trouble is going to be very minimal, because they're going to be apprised of a new duty to register. If you've been terminated through a process of either a court terminating you or you just simply time out, as happens in a few of our states, you are legitimately under the impression that you no longer have to register. You got either a court order you received, or you received a letter from the state saying you no longer have a duty to register. So the knowledge that's required to convict a person is no longer there. When they give you your termination letter, they don't say in the termination letter, and by the way, you need to register in all 49 other states. They don't. That doesn't say that. I mean, chance you've done 271 of these at last count. Does it tell the person they have an obligation in 271 other states? I mean, it doesn't do that.
No, it doesn't. So
this is not a strict liability offense. There are numerous defenses that can be asserted. And I've helped develop and perfect that defense here in my state. And I'm glad to hear that actually what he's talked about is very similar to what our standards are here. And we have a few more play toys to put into the mix here because of my lawmaking skills. We have that they have to send you a notice at least 15 days before your next trip into the registry. And if they haven't sent you notice, that makes it very difficult for them to prove that you had the requisite knowledge because they have failed in one of their obligations as they didn't send the notice. They don't have to prove you got it. They have to be able to demonstrate that they sent it. And if they didn't send the notice, you've got another defense. So it's not a strict liability offense at all. A strict liability offense is like what you describe with a traffic ticket. Well, you're driving down the road and the speed limit's 45 and the sign got stolen or destroyed and you're driving 65. And the officer doesn't care that you didn't know because there's no life-altering consequences of any significance to that. That's mainly an administrative problem. You might get points on your license, your insurance might go up, but your life is not going to be forever altered. With felony convictions, particularly sexual convictions, you're talking about life-altering. It's not a strict liability offense.
Well, all right. I will talk fast, Larry. We have two more things to go. Harvey Weinstein's retrial set for the fall of 2024. Wow, just like a few months from now, really. A New York State court judge on Wednesday afternoon set a new trial for disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein to be retried for sex crimes after his 2020 rape conviction and assault were overturned last week by the state's top appeals court. Manhattan Supreme Court Justice Curtis Farber confirmed that he will hold Weinstein's retrial sometime after Labor Day, the exact date to be determined. They're in a hurry, aren't they?
They are. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office affirmed that they wish to retry Weinstein in light of the 4-3 decision by the state's highest court, New York Court of Appeals, over prejudicial testimony included in his 2020 trial. Quote, we believe in this case and we will be retrying this case, said Nicole Bloomberg, Chief Assistant District Attorney of the Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Bureau at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And I've never heard of such a bureau, but that's kind of cute.
Do you think it's Bloomberg or Blumberg?
Probably Bloomberg.
I think it's Bloomberg stated, We have every belief that the defendant would be convicted again.
And the New York City prosecutors requested a fall trial starting possibly as early as September. Weinstein was wheeled into the 13th floor courtroom by New York courts officers shortly after the hearing commenced. Weinstein has been hospitalized at Bellevue Hospital since Saturday. The angry mob is not going to let go of this case. They're going to demand that he be convicted again. And if he's not convicted on all counts, they're going to try to change the law. That's where this is headed. And they'll probably try to change the law anyway because they don't want any more of these convictions set aside on appeal. So they're going to probably try to weaken the admissibility of propensity evidence and try to make sure that everything that anybody wants to accuse, anybody who wants to testify that has an axe to grind can testify. That's probably what's going to happen.
Chance, do you think it's unusual for after this overturning to get into court that quickly?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But even if they get into court that quickly and it's because it's already been tried, and, you know, the only thing that's setting it back is this particular thing, which should be eliminated in the next trial. Everything else, all the discovery, everything else is pretty much complete. So, you know, it's not like you have to rebuild the will again.
I see. And then finally, this one's kind of long, so bear with me as I read quickly. And this is a violent... Oh boy, Larry, you're going to put up people's hackles. Violent crime is falling nationwide. Here's how we know. This is from the Brennan Center for Justice. The story states, misleading statements about crime and public safety are already proliferating in this election cycle. As November draws closer, misinformation is likely to intensify. That makes it even more important to take a close look at what the best and most recent crime data tells us. One major trend is becoming clear. Violent crime dropped in 2021 and 2022, and then declined again significantly in 23. How can this be, Larry, when everyone knows that crime is through the roof under the Biden administration, especially all the large cities under Democratic control?
Well, that is the talking points, and that's what I wanted to try to illuminate our very sophisticated audience here. Based on data from 38 cities across the country, the Council on Criminal Justice reported that homicide declined by 10% in 2023. It also noted declines in assaults, gun assaults, burglary, and larceny, but a sharp spike in motor vehicle thefts. Similarly, Jeff Asher, a researcher and expert in data on crime and public safety, studied murder rate data from 175 cities and found a 7% decline in murders through December 7, 2023, compared to 2022. These cities are across the country include jurisdictions by Republicans and Democrats alike.
According to the article, a murder decline of this magnitude would be historic. The sharpest one-year drop on record occurred in 1996 when the number of murders nationwide fell by a little more than 9% compared to 1995.
Now, let's just take a look at those years. Do you remember who happened to be in the Oval Office in 1996?
I gotta think it was Clinton.
Yeah, it was. So, as the article states, trends in the largest cities tend to grab headlines and help shape our understanding of national developments. That makes careful examination of the data from these cities especially important. Broadly, the news about the murder trends from 2022 and 2023 is encouraging. There were 100 fewer murders in Philadelphia in 2023 compared to 22, a decline of 20%. In Baltimore, murders declined by roughly 20%, falling below 300 for the first time since 2014, and that was prior to the majestic presidency of Donald Trump. Similarly, New York City saw nearly 50 fewer homicides, a drop of roughly 11%.
I've not heard this before.
You will not, and not likely to, because as the article states, these declines also undercut politicized claims that crime is rising in blue cities. On the contrary, the data demonstrates that Democratic-led cities, which also happen to be some of the nation's largest, most populous, follow, in some cases, lead the national trend toward decreasing violence. You will never hear that on the right-wing media.
Preliminary national data from the FBI confirms falling violent crime. The broad trend matches what researchers have observed in collections of city data about crime trends between 2022 and 2023. Specifically, the FBI's report shows remarkable declines in murder, down 13.2%, violent crime down 5.7%, and property crime down 4.3%. Of the seven major offenses tracked by the FBI, the report shows an increase only in motor vehicle theft, up 10.7%.
Yeah, the data indicates that violence, especially lethal violence, dropped in 2023. Skeptics might still point to reasons to question the apparent decline in crime. For one, crime data generally includes only offenses reported to the police. But could crime reporting dropped? Could this be misleading on the murder? Well, most murders are generally reported. We either have a missing person file or we have a dead person and a body. So I think the murders, we're going to have to accept them at face value. You remember the guy in Atlanta when I did a presentation, or Dallas, or wherever it was, when I was talking about something similar to this, and he said I was giving bogus statistics. Well, I hate to tell you, I think the murder trends are fairly accurate. You can discount some of the others, but this is an accurate account of violent crime is going down. And we're reacting as if we're in this tidal wave of crime.
Where do you hear things like this, though?
Well, I listened to a variety of sources, as I was telling one of our supporters last week that I got a little bit testy with, that just listens to one source. I listened to Mr. Bongino, but also listen to PBS. I also read conservative, and I also read liberal publications. And I try to discern through all that stuff what is likely to be the truth. And then I go to sources that are believed to be reliable to try to validate that. You know, I had a discussion with someone who said that, you know, that Biden has destroyed domestic oil production. I said, well, but the problem is you're wrong. We're at record levels of production. He says, well, how do I validate that? I said, well, one thing, if you don't believe the Energy and Information Administration, go to the company reports, check out Occidental, check out ConocoPhillips, check out Chevron Texaco's corporate reports. They will tell you they're at record levels of production. Are you saying that these good corporate citizens would lie about their production?
Clearly, because they're in on the conspiracy to try and get the Democrats out of office.
So, but they would not say they're at record production. They would say that their production has collapsed. Folks, we're not in a tidal wave of crime. We've had far higher crime rates than we have today. But when you go out and vote, remember this. You're hearing a lot of noise that it simply isn't true.
Well, you know, Larry's right. We're not in a tidal wave of crime. We're in a tsunami of bullshit. And that's exactly what's going on in this country.
Wow, I didn't see that coming, Chance. That was very good.
So,
Chance, would you mind sharing, like, personally, what do you follow as far as your news sources to cut through, well, as you call it, a tsunami of bullshit?
Yeah, I do the same thing that Larry does. I read publications from both sides. I also have, you know, I go to resource pages. I look at stats. You know, I read legal docs, you know, and I do the same thing Larry does. I read between the line, I discern. But I also want to validate any story that I find that says some bold things. And if I can't validate it by going to the original resources, it's fake news. And often I find that when I go to the resources, it's completely the opposite of what it says. And you know, it doesn't matter whether it's coming from the left or the right. You've got to do that because we're not living in an objective, newsworthy environment anymore. We're living in a place where people are building paradigms based on their own narrative. And that's why we're in a tsunami of bullshit.
I like it. All right. Well, I think we are done. Are we done? Anybody else?
We're done. I'm going to carry these articles that are here that I wanted to get to tonight over. But yes, we've exceeded our allocation of time.
Very good. Chance, do you have any parting words? Anything of wisdom?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. That's all I can say.
Very well. Well, you can head over to registrymatters.co for any of the show notes that you would like to gather and email us over at if you want to send hate mail to Larry, send it to crackpot@registrymatters.co or registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Support us over on Patreon at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/registrymatters. And I don't have anything else to tell you. And without anything else, good night, Larry. Good night, Chance. I hope you guys both have a great weekend.
You too. You too. Thank you so much, Andy.
See you next week.
Yep. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.